Ice Radio. It's very nice to have you with us here today. We are coming to you from Sweden in Scandinavia. And as you know, our website is redicecreations.com, R-E-D-I-C-E, creations.com. And today we are going to talk about Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart, and we are going to, I guess in a sense, shatter the consensus image that I think most people have about Mozart, which some have even dubbed the Freemasonic composer. We have Robert Newman with us here on the line today, who will be releasing a book on this subject somewhere at the end of the summer, probably. And Robert has been studying this for quite some time, and we're going to get into this other side of Mozart. We're going to see how this image, as it were, of him has been created, this pivotal composer and a genius image, so to speak, that we have of Mozart at this point. So this is going to be really, really interesting program. So I hope you keep your eyes pierced, as it were, here. Welcome to the program, Robert. Thank you very much for coming on Red Ice Radio.
Well, thank you very much, Henrik. It's a pleasure to be with you and to share these insights and these discoveries with your good self and with your listeners.
Tell us a little bit about yourself, Robert. How long have you been studying this particular subject? And also, tell us how you first got into this and interest, and how did your interest in Mozart first begin?
Well, I'm originally from Scotland, and as a youth, and later, especially during my studies in London, when I studied music, I was as enamored with Mozart as almost any person could be. I wouldn't say fanatical, but I was blown away by the sheer beauty and the depth and the wonder of his music, to the point where I wanted to, I suppose if you love something, you want to understand it more, or at least you want to bring yourself closer to it. So I began examining, reading the standard biographies, of which there are many, of course, and building up over years, and I'm now in my early 50s, a knowledge of Mozart and an understanding of Mozart, an appreciation of Mozart. He tends to be, he's a kind of person who can draw you in. You know, the sheer volume, the sheer, the scale of the correspondence, the number of his pieces, the dramatic nature of his life, etc. All of these tend to be something of a secular religion, in fact. And it's studied internationally. You have huge conferences debating, discussing almost every aspect of his life and career. And so over a period, I looked perhaps more closely than other people, but it gradually emerged that there were made serious inconsistencies with what one is reading and what may actually be the fact of the matter. And not least in the suppression of a great number of composers whose names are hardly known today, who lived at the same time and interacted with him, etc. And then it became obvious that, and that's indisputable, is the number of works which have been falsely attributed to Mozart since his death in 1791, running into hundreds and hundreds of symphonies, concertos, masses, even operas, which are attributed to Mozart, but later deleted from successive versions of the Kirchhoff catalogue. So I was approaching it from that aspect, that how can such a huge, a colossal group of misattributions feature in the life and career of this person? And this fascinated me, and I was determined to start making notes, which I did 15 years ago, but with no idea, really, of what I would uncover. And only in the last 5 years or so have I really started to uncover major, major discrepancies and facts which I can only describe as being suppressed by the mainstream Mozart industry, which incidentally, as you may know, is a multi-million dollar industry. Yes. And spin-offs into recording industry, the tourist industry, the chocolate industry, and everything else. So you start to question the consensus, but you don't leave it there. And I came to a point where I thought, yes, this is now capable of being expressed coherently in the form of a critical book against Mozart and his myth.
What were some of the things that first got your eyes open to this? Do you remember some of the discrepancies that you stumbled upon, so to speak, when you were researching Mozart?
I think the biggest thing is the suppression of evidence. The suppression of information can sometimes be as damaging as propaganda itself. And that was one aspect. There are manuscripts today in various libraries and museums, archives, which have the name of Mozart written on them, although we know for certain that they're actually written by other composers. And this scandal continues even to this day.
I just wanted to ask, do you have any example of some of these the compositions that aren't Mozart's?
I would go as far as to say, and here's the first shock of our conversation, that Mozart, the real Mozart, wrote probably half a dozen works in his entire life.
Okay.
Half a dozen. The rest, if that. Mozart was a musician of no great talent. He was a provincial musician. A provincial musician being propelled, falsified on a scale that is almost is difficult for us to believe. It's difficult for us to understand that the works of William or the plays of William Shakespeare may not have been written by William Shakespeare, but people have been saying this for 300 and 400 years.
Yes,
and we really must at some point start to say what is the alternative. And it's this alternative that I'd like to put forward and sustain by, if necessary, with the source documents that can support this view.
Yes. Well, let's talk a little bit about some of the sources. You mentioned here to me before that you, and there's also other people around the world who have been following this story and have been researching this as well. Isn't that right?
That's correct, yes. Last year, for example, 2008, was publication of a book on The Marriage of Figaro. You know, The Marriage of Figaro is about as big as it gets in Mozart's musical reputation. An opera that was premiered in Vienna on the 1st of May, 1786, a world-famous opera. Surely this has to be by Mozart, but it isn't. It isn't by Mozart. And nor is John Giovanni, nor is Così fan tutte, and nor is the magic flute, the Zauberflöte. This is extraordinary. And each of these things would require some time, but of the 41 symphonies attributed to Mozart, of the 41, hardly one of them is by Mozart. The 27 piano concertos today attributed to Mozart, we know already, and this is already recognized, that the first seven of them are actually arrangements by other composers. They're not by Mozart at all. So the explanation for this, again, I'm happy to provide.
Yes, absolutely. Let's definitely get into here a little bit later. And what are some of the sources then that you've been looking into? And are you saying also that these are sources that are kind of widely available for people to look into themselves, but this hasn't just been brought to attention or brought to light? Is that what you're saying?
Correct. If you take, for example, the symphonies, there's a biography by a man named Maynard Solomon. It's a famous biography of Mozart. On the page 503, footnote 20, he goes on to say that not a single one of Mozart's first 25 symphonies show any evidence of being attributable to Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart. I mean, when you start getting into Mozart by the kilo, then you start to realize that the childhood of Mozart was hugely exaggerated and falsified. You must remember that these events were not taking place in public. They were taking place across Europe, a Europe which was already predisposed to Mozart because of the Holy Roman Empire. And that's exactly the context within which these things took place. Mm-hmm. The Rosicrucians and the Freemasons, and later the Illuminati. Mm-hmm. All of these secret organizations, these fraternities, supported the Mozart myth. for their own reasons. And this is able to be documented, and we're able to show this very clearly. The scale of exaggeration involved, plus, of course, the suppression of the career of Nan Erl Mozart, who was his sister.
Yes.
She was 5 years older than him. She was a formidable pianist, but nobody mentions her, of course. Mozart himself was no genius. He was no genius even as a pianist. In fact, his Vienna years as a pianist were entirely falsified. You can have, in the years of his Vienna career, 1783, 1784, he was in Vienna for 2 years at this point, and according to his correspondence, he was in huge demand as a soloist. Over Lent period, he, in 1784, he staged three concertos with 176 patrons buying tickets and so forth. But the closer you study this, the more you realize it's actually untrue. This is being stage managed. And the historians of the time, take, for example, Heinrich Koch. Heinrich Koch, C-O-C-H, was a musicologist living in Vienna at that time. He wrote a book on piano that involved the deal with piano concertos in 1793. He never once mentions Mozart. Nowhere. Mm-hmm. Nowhere does he talk about him whatsoever. Mozart was completely unknown, except for the elites. The elites who sponsored and patronized him, of course, many of them being members of the same fraternities. This is not a public composer. This is a private composer, unknown to the world, and whose image was largely constructed after his untimely death in December of 1791. In fact, in his lifetime, only three symphonies of Mozart, inverted commas, were actually published, three of the 41. Mm-hmm. And of the 27 piano concertos of inverted commas Mozart, only five of these were published in his lifetime, and none of them are by Mozart. So when we talk about exaggeration, there's surely a limit between exaggeration and wholesale deception. I think we're talking about the latter.
So let's go back and talk a little bit about some of the, you know, Mozart's childhood, as it were, his upbringing, because again, many people have this idea that he's almost like a savant, you know, a genius. He's like 5 years old and just he's an expert at the piano from the get-go. And where does this story come from, so to speak? Do you know that?
Yes, it comes from the prevailing philosophy of the elites at that time, which was, of course, Voltaire and Rousseau. You know, these two French, everything had to be French at this time. The influence of French philosophy was considerable before the French Revolution. You can see this reflected in the operas that were staged in Vienna at that time. Rousseau and Voltaire, believe it or not, they had busts. There were busts to Voltaire. There was a bust to Rousseau in the office of the Prince Archbishop of Salzburg, Colloredo. They were devoted supporters of Rousseau's philosophy. And Rousseau's philosophy, incidentally, after the French Revolution, was imposed on France. And it was Rousseau who believed in this innocent childhood and this, the noble savage. And Mozart was an experiment. He was an experiment. Huh. He was the creation of a musical superman. The creation of a musical superman brought to its maximum extent by traversing the Holy Roman Empire, as Maria Theresa said, like a beggar. Yeah? going from court to... Now, if you ask yourself, how could Leopold Mozart, his father, have arranged 7 years of touring across Europe? Can you imagine the logistics of that? And he himself was nothing more than a violinist. In fact, he had studied philosophy at the University of Salzburg. Mm-hmm. He was no great musician also. He rose to a position of vice Kapellmeister, which is nothing significant. Where did he find the time as a working class man, as a middle class man at best, to write this voluminous correspondence to potentates, princes, archbishops, patrons all across Europe for a total span of 7 years of touring. And how is it that Mozart never went to school in his entire life? I mean, we really must question who is being exploited here. Mozart, as a child, was brought up to be unchallenged, if you like. He was never really challenged until, surprisingly, he came to Vienna as a 12-year-old child in 1768, after his tours of accommodating patrons in Italy, France, England, and so forth. But in 1768, when he arrived in Vienna, to their surprise, and he was accompanied by his father, the Viennese, and you can see it in the correspondence, the Mozart correspondence, the Viennese didn't believe in the Mozart roadshow. They didn't believe it. Mm-hmm. They challenged him. For the very first time, Leopold Mozart was challenged on his son's musical abilities, and Leopold was so upset with this that he managed to obtain an appointment with the emperor, saying at that meeting, "How is it that my son has traveled all across Europe, but nobody here in Vienna believes in him?" Mm-hmm. You know, in England, they welcomed him, he said, they welcomed him as a genius. But why is it that even the Austrian people can't accept? And out of this embarrassing meeting came a commission for young Wolfgang to write an opera, which 4 months later they brought back to Vienna from Salzburg. But it was immediately noticed that this opera had been ghostwritten. The young boy didn't know anything about it at all. The opera was abandoned. The name of the opera was La Finta Semplice. La Finta Semplice was supposed to have been paid for by the Empress and the Emperor, but it was such an embarrassing fiasco that it was cancelled, and they were not paid. There's no record of any payment. And they went back to Vienna, and finally their Jesuit friends in Vienna staged it once only in 1769. This is the truth of Mozart, unlike the fairy story. And this continued. It continued and continued until Mozart finally arrived in 1781 with the mythical story of his break from service with Salzburg, with Archbishop Colloredo, and he became a freelance composer. At least that's what the story says. Mm-hmm. But the reality is very different.
And you mentioned Mozart as a kind of an experiment, as a music superman, in that sense that they were trying to create this musical genius in that sense. But I guess also then that means that it was a failed experiment, and it was all about the perception of the man and not really actually what he was able or capable of doing. Is that right?
That is correct. In order to achieve this task, you would have needed a group of composers who were supplying this music. Who were the true composers of this music? Well, if I give you a few names, let's see if you are aware of them. Mm-hmm. One of them is Van Hal, V-A-N-H-A-L.
Nope.
Van Hal. Okay, Van Hal is unknown today, highly suppressed. He was virtually a next-door neighbor of Vienna, of Mozart throughout his Vienna career. Van Hal was a great composer, and Van Hal's music stops at the moment when Mozart arrived in town. Van Hal, if you check out, he was a great composer from Bohemia. Another one I might just mention, and this is now well-known, was Joseph Myslivacek. Another Bohemian composer, Joseph Myslivacek. Mm-hmm. He wrote many symphonies and sonatas, which are today still attributed to Mozart. Hmm. Joseph Myslivacek. In fact, Joseph Myslivacek is mentioned more in the Mozart correspondence than any other composer. And yet today, if you ask about Joseph who? That's right. Joseph Myslivacek.
Tell us just a little briefly about this, the Mozart correspondence. Is that a book compiled of letters and so forth, or what is that?
The Mozart correspondence is the voluminous exchange of letters between Leopold, Mozart, Wolfgang, Leopold, Nan Earl, Leopold, etc. The family correspondence.
Mm-hmm.
And this is, in the 18th century, it was expensive to write letters. You know, ordinary people didn't usually do this. But we are asked to believe that the Mozart family carried on this huge correspondence. They had no time for anything else except mountains of correspondence. So that today we have hundreds and hundreds. But the strange thing about the Mozart correspondence, if you look at the last 10 years of Mozart's life, there are hundreds of letters from him to various people.
Mm.
But there is not one single letter to him from his entire Viennese career, 1781 to 1791. Not a single letter has survived. Not one.
Okay.
That's a strange fact. No?
Yeah, that sure is. Why do you think that is then? Because he simply didn't get any, right? Or what?
Because the entire career of Mozart is being staged, managed.
Yes.
That's why.
But you don't. This is not about like the guy never existed or anything like that. This is more like he was working within music, are you saying? But he wasn't that big of a deal really when it comes to composing, and he wasn't certainly not a genius, but he was around at that period. Do you think still? You know.
He was playing a role. Mozart was really an actor.
Okay.
He was a person who went through the motions. It would bring glory. He had been persuaded that this was in the best interests of the status quo, the people who controlled him, that they would bring glory to Vienna. They would bring this happened later with Beethoven to some extent. You shouldn't do another program on that one. But Mozart by this time was so used to lying, and his family. His father died in 1787, 4 years before he died. But Mozart was so used to the falsification, so supported by other musicians, that to him it was perfectly normal. And these things were further concealed by the early biographies written by Nemeček in Prague in 1797, highly suppressed. They destroyed the first edition of this biography, by the way. And the second biography was written by his widow, Constanze Mozart, in Denmark in 1827.
Mm-hmm.
And this, too, is full of errors and falsifications. So on these two foundations, the entire Mozart mythology was built, plus, of course, the posthumous publication of works that nobody had ever heard of. They suddenly started pouring out of the tap. You know, there were 500 or so works published after his death, which made up the main part of the myth that we know today as Mozart.
Do you think that those pieces were actually also even written after his death, or were those just written by someone else during his time and then brought out later, or where do you think they came from?
Well, a combination of both. Many were written after his death, but some were revised and completely rewritten, reorchestrated by his patrons.
Hmm. And yes, you mentioned before also the importance here, so to speak, of the Roman Holy Roman Empire being behind this, the emperor in Vienna and so forth. Because I'm a little bit uncertain in regards to time frame here. Is this the Habsburg dynasty that we're talking about, or what dynasty do you know which is involved in this?
And surprisingly, the emperor at that time, Joseph II, was a good man. He was not involved in this nonsense, but other members of his family were, such as Max Franz, who is his younger brother. His younger brother became the elector of Cologne, the elector at Bonn in 1784. He was one of the principal patrons of Mozart's career. You must remember that Austria had suffered setback after setback militarily in the 18th century. They had no musical geniuses in German-speaking musical geniuses. So they were all Italian. Mm. All the Kapellmeisters were Italian. They were Bohemians, they were Italians, but where were the Germans? And so they have to create the illusion, the impression with Joseph Haydn, then later with Mozart, and finally with Beethoven, that there is an indigenous German genius. Not only this, but this indigenous German genius is worthy of being used to create the idea of Vienna as the city of music. And as for history, or where the symphony comes from, where the music actually comes from, well, that was easily suppressed over the next century.
You know, just to put this into context also for people listening, many researchers have been talking about the manipulation behind the 60s, for example, about how many, you know, artists, rock groups have been composed. And again, we only have to think of what's going on today in regards to, in many cases, there isn't really a skill behind many of the artists that we see, you know, on the MTV or here on the radio, what have you. These are constructions that are put together. It's a combination of, a nice looking face and another one's voice. Maybe we don't exactly know how everything happens here, so to speak, but there's a lot of tricks going on in order to kind of basically fool people into believing that, you know, wow, what a talent, you know, he or she's, you know, good looking, yada yada, all this stuff. And what you're describing here is a similar thing, but probably one of the first examples of this taking place in history, right?
Absolutely. This is so correct. This is I can't stress enough how correct that is. It is the movie industry of the 18th, well, it's the show business of the 18th century.
There you go.
In a time when there was no copyright, in a time when composers really couldn't earn a living and would do anything to, but the publishers of the 18th century in Vienna, these people were party to what was happening. Of course they were. But I also want to stress that the Illuminati by the 1780s, which were really an offshoot of the Jesuits. And I have to say this because the Jesuits were the schoolmasters, they were the confessors of kings right across the Holy Roman Empire. They were they educated Leopold Mozart. Out of the suppression of the Jesuits, as you know, came many things. And one of them was the end of their monopoly on the book industry, the book publishing industry. Until 1773, the Jesuits controlled publishing completely. Mm. They controlled music publishing. They were they vetted every book that was published. But in 1773, they were forced to go underground, and they reemerged as they did in the Renaissance through Rosicrucianism, through the Freemasons, and finally through the Illuminati. All of these things really are simply secret organizations which pretend not to have any leanings towards anything, but all roads lead eventually. And so this situation arose where a network existed to create a wonder image using the talents of many, many composers. And this required decades. And that's why the Mozart catalog finally doesn't arrive until the 1850s, 60 years after his death.
Hmm.
A lot of industry, a lot of falsification, a big story, you know.
Absolutely. So, what would you say? I mean, we understand this now that the situation in Austria wasn't that great at that time. They needed something to kind of prop themselves up and so forth. But if we look at it from an even maybe larger context, what do you think at this point was the, you know, more maybe perhaps than motives for this or purpose for creating this image? Or are we talking about music as manipulation as well, perhaps? Or I don't know if you want to go into that area.
Yes. Music was always propaganda. Music was used as propaganda by the Jesuits even before 1773. They were the pioneers of theater. This was a form of proselytizing the country. In 1731, in Salzburg, 30,000, this is remarkable, 30,000 inhabitants of Salzburg were kicked out of the city or kicked out of the principality. Why? Because they weren't Roman Catholic.
Mm-hmm.
This was in 1731, 20 years before Mozart's death. Talk about intolerance. This was in the middle of winter. And this was not in the 15th century or 60th. This is in the 18th century, 1731.
Hmm. And do you know what happened? Did they freeze to death or did they just escape? And these were Protestants or what was the
The Jesuits the Jesuits, with their counter-reformation, of course they hated Luther, they hated the Protestant Reformation, the Jesuits were determined to fight a counter-reformation, to re-evangelize in the name of the Catholic Church, and they finally arrived in Salzburg in 1731, 20 years before Mozart, or 25 years before Mozart's birth. And they were amazed to find that the huge numbers of the population were not signing up to their program. And this enraged the Prince Archbishop of Salzburg, so he gave them 8 days to leave the city. You can check it out for yourself. It's a well-known fact of German Austrian history. And they went to different countries, and they were traveling for several years and finally found different places to stay.
So just, okay, just clarify for us again and our listeners here. Mozart, does he have a connection then with the Jesuits, or is this a Protestant revolutionary agenda that is behind the propping up of Mozart?
The Jesuit order went underground from 1773 onwards.
Right.
So therefore, you won't find direct reference of the Jesuits helping Mozart. You will not find that after 1773. But you will find his association with the fraternities. And that's why he becomes a Freemason. That's why he has many friends who are Illuminati. If you were to check his patrons and his friends, it's amazing how many of them are involved in Illuminatist activity, the fraternity. You know, the difference, really, to put an ethical point on it, is this, that Christianity is an open religion. It was not done in a corner. It was not hidden. It was public. It was outright. It was straightforward. But the fraternities made everything a secret religion, a mystical religion, revealed only in degrees. You see, the attraction of this. Plus, of course, there was the attraction of the new knowledge of the Renaissance. The Renaissance brought, literally, the Renaissance was the rebirth, the rebirth of pagan philosophy. Also mathematics, of course. But pagan philosophy was very tempting, and many people, even non-Catholics, were seduced into believing that being a member of the Rosicrucians or a member of the Freemasons was not such a bad thing. It was enlightening people, and it was helping. They didn't realize, of course, that this was just a vessel, a way in which the population could be eventually manipulated and brought back under control, so that the reforms of Joseph II in Austria on his death were reversed within 4 or 5 years of his death. All the reforms, all the religious toleration was finished. The great reforming emperor, Joseph II, he spent his entire life trying to reform what was really unreformable.
Very interesting. And how about the music then in that regard? Do you enjoy the music still to listen to it?
Absolutely. So I would go, I still say that some of this music is some of the greatest of all. But the cost is tremendous. It's the suppression of wonderful works, wonderful musical work. Have you heard of a composer named Cartellieri?
No.
Well, Cartellieri is a great composer who helped in the creation of Mozart's career and also even early Beethoven. Cartellieri died very young, but some of his music is absolutely wonderful and suppressed. Only recently have a few recordings been made of Cartellieri's music, Van Hal's music. This is the cost of building an icon, a massive icon such as Mozart. And it was perpetuated, you know. If you look at the early history of the London Philharmonic Orchestra, 1813, the first year's concerts were dominated by, inverted commas, Mozart. Dominated by Mozart, because that orchestra was created by the fraternities.
Interject that. Do you think that this also could be then about control in one sense, that they wanted to control or quiet the opposition if many people or too many composers are in there, you know?
Absolutely. It's like an agency. You have an agency of 20 people, but it's so much easier life is so much easier if you just focus on one or two people and make them into idols.
Yeah.
And that's how they did it. Mozart just happened to be the selected candidate for that job. Everyone else would be forgotten, but they wouldn't forget the great icon that is Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart. Mm. They would because it would be wall to wall Mozart, you know.
Yes, but this was also, I guess, in this period. I mean, the common man, so to speak, didn't have the money to go to a concert, right? This was for the royalty, the nobility, and things like this. Maybe people who at that time got involved in politics or whatever, right?
Exactly. Well, this is the whole point, is that when the French Revolution came, and here's the twist in the story, people knew that society couldn't continue much longer. But the conservatives, that is to say the elites, had their own system of trying to survive. And one of them was to create the wunderkind Mozart. Mm. You know, you can't destroy this society. Look what we've created. Look how marvelous this. So this was part of their thinking, that the survival of the state would be okay because we have these wonderful geniuses. And what better way than to cover yourself with the culture, the cultural achievements of Austria and Germany? Who could question this? And so the Marriage of Figaro, which anticipates the French Revolution, seems to be an example of liberalism. Yeah, it's exactly what it was intended to do, to perpetuate the power of these elites, who were the patrons, of course, of art in those days.
And so this is also about disseminating the Enlightenment philosophy, so to speak, to these people who had the money to attend the concerts or were invited or what have you. That is very interesting. And you mentioned the Marriage of Figaro. We can go in a little bit later, maybe we can talk a little bit more about the magic flute, because that's the one, you know, that people have focused on as with the most kind of Freemasonic connotation, so to speak. So we can talk about that later on. But in regards to, are there any other plays or operas or concertos that you think conveys this message as well?
Of Freemasonry, or of symbolism you're speaking about?
Well, of Enlightenment, maybe, the philosophy of the revolutionary era, something like that?
Well, it's an interesting subject. If you look at the early opera Idomeneo, which is not a comic opera, it's an opera seria. It was written in Munich before Mozart came to Vienna, an early opera of Mozart, Idomeneo. The characters in this opera, if you analyze them closely enough, they're all representing real people, of which Mozart is only one. So there is a how would you say, a subliminal element to the Mozart operas.
Mm.
Another point is that the Mozart operas, as we know them, were constructed mostly after his lifetime. None of them were published in his lifetime. The orchestral score, I mean, this many years after his death before they were published. And if we can speak about the Marriage of Figaro at some point, I'll be a very fascinating subject.
Absolutely. Let's get into that in the next segment. Sorry to cut you off. Please continue.
I was going to say that the score of the Marriage of Figaro, the one which was premiered in Vienna on the 1st of May, 1786, special day this for the Illuminati, by the way, the 1st of May 1786 was the premiere of Le Nozze di Figaro. What they don't tell you in the biographies is the hissing and booing that came from the audience. It was so poorly written. And if you go back and to the National Library of Austria in Vienna and look at the score itself, something that Mozartians don't really somehow seem to do, we got the first images of these and we published them last year. And it's riddled with mistakes. This music is manipulated. It was much later that it was revived and reorchestrated in Prague by Mozart's Apollonian supporters, and finally published years after his death in a form which is very, very different from what was originally performed. So, you know, this is a very interesting subject.
And you mentioned the was it Museum of Vienna that you found these documents in?
Well, before the opera was premiered on the 1st of May, they obviously needed to rehearse it.
Mm.
And this document, the score, the orchestral and choral score, is today in the library in Vienna. And it's surprising, it's very surprising, that, no, can you believe it, that in 200 years of Mozart study, nobody's actually studied it?
Hmm, really? And these are accessible? You've been there yourself, looked at
them? Yes, we made microfiches of the entire document.
Mm-hmm.
So they didn't like it. I mean, the museum didn't like it, but we did it, and we paid for it.
Hmm. Wow, that's really interesting. And you is this something that you will have published in your upcoming book, Robert?
It's already been published in 2008, we have these photographs, these images, etc. Now,
and where can just before you continue, and where can people find that? And mention the book, or where can we go to look at it?
Yeah. How about if you could do a web search for Figaro, L'aria della Contessa.
Oh, well, you have to spell that for me later on, and we can put up a link to that on the website.
Yes, you can read about the background history to this. But there was a second score made by Mozart himself, and it's this one which is on sale at the moment. You can buy a copy of Mozart's score of The Marriage of Figaro, and you think, wow, that's incredible. Look at that. It's wonderful. But that's not the score that was used in 1786. It was made later. And they don't tell you that.
Hmm.
So yeah, this is a marvelous subject. Believe me, there is a parallel universe. One of them is the transcendental myth of Mozart, and the other one, unfortunately, is the one of history.
So, well, there you go. Well, we know we've talked so much on this program about the discrepancies and all the falsification, basically, of history for the winners and those from the ruling elite side in order to steer current events into the direction where they want to have them steer to in order to control us, obviously, much better.
Henrik, it's the dumbing down.
Yeah.
It's the dumbing. It's once again, it's the dumbing down of society.
Absolutely.
How much easier would it be to have a giggling genius who is doing everything? Yeah. Mm. It's so simple. You just portray these people as being transcendentally gifted. They don't, you know, Mozart never studied a single day in his life composition. He was under no teacher at any time in his entire life.
Mm-hmm.
His family didn't even own a piano until the year before he came to Vienna.
How old was he then, do you know?
When Mozart came to Vienna?
Yeah.
He was 26 at this time.
So that doesn't fit, right? Because he was playing and writing on the piano when he was like 5 years old, right? So where did he get that from?
He was playing on the piano at 20. He learned some pieces, sure.
Mm-hmm.
But he didn't perform publicly. It's not as if you could go up to see him. When he came to London, his father charged 1 shilling for the short time he was here. Well, ordinary people couldn't do that. This was the middle classes. This was the higher classes who could do this.
Mm.
And so, yes, of course, he could perform pieces. But as it happens, his sister, Nan Earl, was recognized to be far superior. There are numerous records saying that Mozart's skill is not so special. It was easily superior. Other people were easily superior from the time, but you don't hear about those, of course.
That's interesting, and it seems to be also then it follows the trend of the male suppressing the female in this case, as it were, and they needed a man for this, you know, not a woman.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, the piano concertos attributed to Mozart came to Mozart through Salzburg, and involved in their creation was none other than the much suppressed Nan Earl Mozart, and also the blind pianist Maria Theresia von Paradis. These were some of the greatest virtuosos of the 18th century, and they were both women.
Mm.
But you don't hear about that.
That's very interesting.
Theresia von Paradis was asked to leave Vienna because Mozart had just arrived, and she went off. She was blind. Can you imagine that? And she was blind, and yet she helped this myth get off the ground. I mean, there were ways of doing this, and she went on tour and she never returned.
And it's quite interesting as well, because these names that you mentioned here, more recently here, Maria Theresa von Paradis and also Nannerl Mozartin, do you think that these are ladies who trained a lot on the piano, and they weren't like gifted from day one in that sense, but they were actually, you know, hard working, so to speak, and really learning and progressing in life as well?
Absolutely. Nannerl Mozart in particular was highly accomplished, a great creative thinker, but they did rather more than this. It wasn't simply those two. They had living in Leopold Mozart's house were various composers. This is a bit of a bombshell, but there were several composers living in Mozart's house in Salzburg during the creation stage of these concertos and various other works also. Men such as, let me mention one or two of them, because just you can check for yourself. Joseph Fiala, F-I-A-L-A. Joseph Fiala lived in the house of the Mozarts in Salzburg, a composer. Yet another person that you don't hear about.
Is there any record of these composers, like protesting or screaming at the top of their lungs? Stolen.
They understood the game.
Okay.
That was the way that it worked.
Do you think that they were bought out? Like, yes, compose for us, and we'll give you money for this.
They came from a strict religious background. Van Hal did, you know. They all did. And so they were no doubt convinced that this was in the best interest of whatever it was they were trying to achieve. There were only three or four people who challenged this, and perhaps we can talk about that later.
Absolutely, and I definitely want to get in. I have so many more questions I want to ask you here, Robert. But I think that this is a good place to take a little break, listen to some music, and then continue here talking more in our member section. And so what we can say right now then is that we don't have a direct website that we can give out, but we definitely want to alert people that you're going to have a book out on the subject sometime after the summer. Is that correct? Do you have titles ready, anything like that people can search for?
That's correct. I'm still working on this, but yes, towards the end of this year, perhaps August, September, I hope to finish, if others don't finish before me. So.
Okay, very good. Well, stay with us then, Robert. We're going to continue here in our member section. Thank you very much for joining us here for the first hour. We'll take a short break, and we will be right back. We'll continue to talk more about the Illuminati, the Jesuits, Mozart's death, his potential poisoning. We'll also talk about the marriage of Figaro, the Requiem, and the Magic Flute, the Freemasonic opera, and that it might represent a kind of fusion between the secret societies and their initiation. We'll also discuss the Thurn and Taxi family, the French Revolution, monarchy, and much more. But we'll begin to talk about the importance of the city of Prague. So if you've enjoyed part one and want to continue listening, you can join us in the member section. Sign up at our website, redicecreations.com, and for about €3 a month, you'll get full access to our entire radio archive with the radio, video, and webcasts. And when you sign up, you'll get instant access. Also, I want to correct one thing. The European Union anthem that they picked, Ode to Joy, that is, of course, by Beethoven and not Mozart. But in any regard, the bumper music won't be difficult to choose this time. Let's listen to some Mozart, and we'll talk more in the member section after this. Thank you. Thank you.